I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Shalom, and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions in Hickson, Tennessee. Now here's your host, IBJM Ministries Director, John Lawrence.
Greetings to our listening audience. I'm John Lawrence, the Director of Ministries here at IBJM and your host for the program today. Israel is very much in the news these days, right in focus. And with so much going on, Israel really needs our prayers. Are we faithful to pray for the peace of Jerusalem as the Bible suggests that we should? The state of Israel, of course, today is surrounded by turmoil. There's civil war up there in Syria. There's disarray in Lebanon, where that terrorist group Hezbollah wields a lot of power. There's Egypt, which is in turmoil and plagued with a lot of conflict between multiple factions, now the military there firmly in control. The Hamas terror group controls the Gaza Strip. And Iraq, we hear, is also falling into turmoil and increased violence, more every day, it seems. In the midst of all that, Israel is being pressed by our American administration to make peace with the Palestinians, even though there is little or no real basis to engage in any kind of fruitful discussions, given the positions of the Palestinian Authority. For instance, the Palestinian leaders refuse to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Recently, the ruling authorities in the West Bank forged an alliance with Hamas, a terror group, which rules the Gaza Strip. And they did that in the midst of their negotiations with Israel for peace. Of course, that has led to a pretty near collapse of the peace talks, which Israel immediately suspended. How do you make peace with a group that is sworn to the destruction of your people and to the destruction of your country, as Hamas is? They have steadfastly refused to alter that position in any way. The Palestinian Authority has also sought to circumvent the peace process by appealing to the UN to join various agencies and commissions that have been understood to be off limits until a peace agreement would be forthcoming. But many analysts believe that peace and a two-state agreement is simply an elusive dream of our government officials that really has little basis in the reality of the situation on the ground in the Middle East. Israel has made many concessions, including releasing dozens of terrorists who have murdered innocent Israeli citizens in random attacks on their populace. With Israel's security on the line, Prime Minister Netanyahu has wisely drawn a line in the sand to say, "This is as far as we can go." To tolerate Hamas in a formal government of the Palestinian Authority, with their current charter calling for the destruction of Israel, would be really near unthinkable. So it seems, once again, these ill-advised peace talks will soon collapse of their own very heavy baggage. Israel will likely be bearing the brunt of the blame in the press for that failure, and among Western allies who seem to really desire more to forge peace at any price than to really arrive at a durable settlement that would guarantee Israel's future security. But we know, of course, that there will be no real peace without the Prince of Peace, that is Jesus the Messiah. A peace founded on unwise compromises will not endure. It's destined to fail. The nature of man has not changed, of course, and so discord, hatred and war still dominate the human condition, even though we seem less willing to admit it. And of course, that situation, that core nature of man, cannot be reformed by men's action. That takes God's supernatural plan of salvation to change the heart and mind of man. But we are commanded in any case to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, for God's protection and God's mercy, and especially pleading with the Lord that they might be saved. Pray that there will be people to share the gospel in these times of trouble there in Israel. Now let's listen to Jewish believer Brother Mark Oshman with today's Bible lesson.
Welcome back to another session of our radio Bible study. We have focused on answering Jewish objections to Christian interpretations of Messianic prophecy. Here are several arguments that Jews can raise against the Christian understanding of Isaiah chapter 53. Some Jews might take issue with the Christian interpretation of the setting in that passage. They might contend that Isaiah 53 spoke about the return of the Jewish exiles from Babylon, and not about the coming Messiah. The verses in question are found in an extended section of Isaiah's prophecy connected with God's servant. In Isaiah chapter 40, the prophet proclaims, quote, "Behold, the Lord God will come with strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him." Unquote. Two chapters later, God spoke about his servant who would, quote, "bring forth judgment to the Gentiles." Unquote. Sometimes the servant in question referred to the Jewish nation itself. In Isaiah 45, God spoke after this fashion, quote, "For Jacob, my servant's sake, and Israel, mine elect, I have even called thee by name." Unquote. God used the term servant in a similar way in Isaiah chapter 49, quote, "Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified." Unquote. However, on other occasions, the writers in Isaiah distinguish between God's servant and the Jewish people. Look at Isaiah 53, where Isaiah stated that God's servant, quote, "hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows," unquote. The prophet also noted that that servant had been, quote, "wounded for our transgressions," unquote, and, quote, "bruised for our iniquities," unquote. Furthermore, Isaiah noted that, quote, "the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all," unquote. Notice all of the uses of the pronoun "our" and "we." The servant of Isaiah 53 must be different from those on whose behalf he suffered. Those who seek to apply Isaiah 53 to the returning exiles from Babylon face another problem. In that passage, Isaiah 53, God spoke about the servant making his soul an offering for sin. If the nation of Israel is the servant in Isaiah 53, the prophet then implied that the sufferings of the Jewish people somehow made atonement for their Babylonian captors. Jewish suffering as a vehicle for bringing atonement to others is a relatively recent strain of Jewish thought. Nowhere did the Old Testament teach or imply that Jewish people can redeem the world through their afflictions. Some Jews might contend that Isaiah chapter 53 contained only the words of repentant Gentile kings, not the words of the Jewish people themselves. To bolster that claim, they might point to a verse that appeared in Isaiah chapter 52. Quote, "The king shall shut their mouths at him, for that which hath not been told them shall they see, and that which they have not heard shall they consider." Unquote. In light of the words that follow that statement, quote, "who hath believed our report?" Unquote. The pronoun "our" referred to the kings mentioned in the previous verse, so the Jewish people who might raise that argument could claim. However, Isaiah 53 made it clear that the pronouns "our" and "we" depicted the Jewish nation, not the Gentile kings. When the prophet declared that, quote, "we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted," unquote, he used words that only a Jew would have spoken. According to Psalm 96, the so-called gods of the Gentiles were actually idols. The concept of substitutionary atonement played no role in pagan belief. What Gentile king could express the statement, as found in Isaiah 53, that, quote, "for the transgression of my people was he stricken," unquote. Furthermore, the Old Testament implied that Gentile kings would not repent. Some too portrayed them as taking counsel against the Lord and his anointed, opposing them. Ezekiel 38 and 39 show the group of Gentile kings fielding armed forces against the people of Israel. These actions don't indicate any degree of contrition upon the part of Gentile kings. Why assume that in Isaiah chapter 53 they would show such contrition? Some Jews believe in two prophesied messiahs: the suffering Messiah, known as Messiah ben Joseph, and the conquering Messiah, known as Messiah ben David. A Jew might argue that rabbis applied the verses in Isaiah 52 to the suffering Messiah, but they applied verses in Isaiah 53 to the conquering Messiah. The Old Testament does not support the existence of two Messiahs. Isaiah chapter 41, for instance, referred to, quote, "thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel," unquote. thy Redeemer as in singular, not Redeemers as plural. Some Jews advance arguments that they believe show that Jesus Christ could not possibly be the servant of Isaiah 53. They might, for instance, turn to the second verse of that chapter. There is no beauty that we should desire him. They might contrast that with the large audiences that Jesus Christ attracted during his ministry, especially during the early days. The verse in Isaiah does not address the degree of popularity that the servant would enjoy. The immediate context of that passage provided the background necessary to understand what meaning Isaiah intended to convey. Isaiah noted that the servant, quote, shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of a dried ground, unquote. Those words suggested the obscurity surrounding the servant's origins. In the first chapter of John, a man by the name of Nathanael responded to Philip's news about Jesus Christ by posing a question. Quote, can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? Unquote. Nazareth, where Jesus Christ spent his adolescence, Nazareth was, and remains, a relatively insignificant village in the Galilee. Isaiah also remarked that the servant, quote, hath no form nor comeliness, unquote. This observation corresponded to the prophet's earlier observation that the servant was marred beyond recognition. Consider the experiences that Jesus Christ underwent in the final hours of his life, being beaten by the members of the Sanhedrin, being scourged by the Romans, being nailed to a cross. The description given by Isaiah seemed to fit what Jesus Christ went through and how he appeared after he went through these things. Moreover, Jesus Christ was not popular throughout his public ministry. A point came when, quote, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him, unquote, according to John chapter 6. In fact, in the final few hours of his earthly life, Jesus Christ heard a cry where the crowd called for his crucifixion. At that point, you might say relatively few people desired him. Along similar lines, some Jews might argue that the servant in Isaiah 53 cannot refer to Jesus Christ, because that passage described the servant as being sickly. They use the words, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief in Isaiah 53, claiming that that phrase should read, quote, a man of pains and accustomed to illness. Given the Jewish expectations of Messiah being a vigorous man, it seems unlikely that many Jews would want to follow a messianic claimant who was physically infirm. Many Jewish leaders, such as Moses and Samuel, retained their vigor and vitality even in old age. What would attract a Jew to a messianic claimant who was chronically infirm? Do the Hebrew words in Isaiah 53 indicate physical illness? The Hebrew word for sorrows is makov. It can refer either to physical pain or metaphysical distress. In the latter sense, David used that word in Psalm 32 when he wrote that many sorrows, makov, many sorrows shall be to the wicked. What about the word rendered as grief? The Hebrew equivalent of that word, holi, can likewise refer to physical or metaphysical maladies. In Ecclesiastes 5, the author used holi in connection with the decrepitude that a laboring man experiences. Translating the verse in Isaiah 53 with reference to the servant being a weak or sickly individual would seem to be a matter of interpretation. It would involve reading into the passage a meaning that the author in context did not suggest it to have. At any rate, Isaiah continued by writing this verse, quote, surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, unquote. This passage seemed to indicate that the griefs and sorrows in question tended to be metaphysical in nature and not physical. With this, we conclude another radio broadcast. Thank you very much for listening to our programs. Please join us for future broadcasts about answering Jewish objections to Christians' interpretations of Messianic prophecy.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee, 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.